executives of Santander Securities responsible for issuing the bonds. And so, yes, that is exactly correct. When the debt became unsustainable in 2014...
We only have about 15 seconds to go. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
In 2014 and 2015, and the Fiscal Control Board was appointed by the Obama administration. Of the seven political appointees, those two executives were appointed to the Fiscal Control Board to determine what entities will be paid under the debt restructuring.
We want to thank you very much for being with us. Teresa Casertano, the Global Campaign's Organizing Coordinator with CWA. This is Democracy Now! Happy birthday to Renee Feltz. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Democracy Now!
KBOO Portland, the time is now 4:59. Actually, it just turned to 5 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certifications requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The events committee meets the third Thursday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held. To request notice a board meeting in writing, please email monica@kboo.org.
On Friday, December 16th, join From the Grassroots, where we agitate for social change with music and commentary on our special Christmas Soul Show. Local and national political commentary provided by Landon Crowell, and always musical analysis by our art historian, Diane Johnson. So join From the Grassroots, December 16th from 8 p.m. until 10 on 90.7 FM, KBOO Portland. We'll be very special Christmas.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a Multnomah County man was denied a new trial despite claims of racial prejudice.
Portland passes the Open and Accountable Elections Law.
And KBOO's Don Merrill speaks with Oregon District 3 Representative Carl Wilson.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, December 6th, 2016. I'm Stacey Holtman.
And I'm Liam Delta. On Wednesday, the same day the Portland City Council unanimously voted to ban fossil fuel storage terminals and encourage electric vehicles in the city, it also approved a new campaign finance measure. The measure, called Open and Accountable Elections Portland, sponsored by Amanda Fritz, is similar to one that was voted down here in 2010. The law is intended to keep local elections from being dominated by big money interests. It provides public money to match small donations for citizens running for public office in Portland. The motion passed 3-2 with Charlie Hales and Commissioner Steve Novick supporting Fritz. The blog Sightline.org said, quote, just 400 wealthy individuals played an important role in financing the 2016 mayoral race.
A Multnomah County man was denied a new trial despite claims of racial prejudice. On Thursday, Judge Bronson James denied the motion for a new trial for Olin Jermaine Williams in Multnomah County Circuit Court. The motion argued the 33-year-old African-American man did not have a fair trial because only one of the 12 jurors in his case was African-American, and that juror's opinion was not enough to result in a mistrial. In Oregon, only 10 of 12 votes are needed for a conviction in all felony cases except murder trials. The law was implemented by an approved ballot measure in 1934, designed to silence non-white voices on juries. Only Oregon and Louisiana have such laws on the books. According to the Oregonian, Judge Bronson's opinion found no direct evidence of racial bias motivating the majority of jurors, but he did express concern for the racist history of the law and its treatment of African-American defendants. The Oregon Justice League and the ACLU of Oregon filed amicus briefs in support of Williams' motion.
Despite the fact that total accumulations were generally well under 2 inches, Wednesday's snowstorm managed to bring the entire region to a standstill. Commutes that normally take minutes stretched into hours, emergency and highway department vehicles were gridlocked, and school children spent hours waiting for buses or stuck in buses that were trapped in traffic. And with the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration predicting a wetter and colder winter than normal for the Pacific Northwest, the question becomes, what did we do wrong and how do we avoid it in the future? The first step appears to be simple. Pay attention to the weather forecast. The National Weather Service predicted the storm, and Oregon Department of Transportation had asked drivers to avoid travel, but few took the advice. Schools and businesses opened as normal, and then when the storm hit at noon, everyone hit the roads at the same time. The highway department had been pre-treating the roads with gravel and de-icing solutions, but rock salt is generally not used in Oregon, and the roads quickly glazed over. From there, it was all downhill. The Portland Bureau of Transportation had their plow trucks out, but they quickly became stuck in massive traffic jams. For many parents, the biggest concern was the whereabouts of their children. There was little communication from school officials, and many children didn't arrive home until late at night, sometimes not until parents went to retrieve them. School officials admitted that communication was poor and that they need a better method to get the word out. They also said they plan to take a more conservative approach to school closures due to weather in the future.
Carl Wilson is a Republican representative in the Oregon legislature. He serves District 3, which covers Grants Pass and Josephine County, far outside the reach of KBOO's broadcast signal. But his influence on committees that focus on education, spending, and marijuana sales affect the entire state. Don Merrill, KBOO's beat reporter for the State House, talked with Representative Wilson in the first part of a two-part conversation about PERS, the Public Employee Retirement System, taxes, and the new presidential administration.
When I read your biography on the Oregon Legislative Assembly website, you say you'll help craft good laws and make sure that the legislature gives Southern and rural Oregon the respect it deserves. Now, does that mean that you think that there are bad laws that don't give respect to rural and Southern Oregonians? And if so, why do you think that's happened?
You know, we've got an urban-rural divide like most states do. And a lot of times, those of us from the hinterlands feel that much of the legislative process is predicated by urban areas. And so what we're asking for is just simply that as we move along in the next legislative session, from the governor on down, that everyone realizes there are 36 counties in this state, and we would just appreciate being remembered as law is crafted here.
Now, you are also the vice chair on the Joint Interim Committee on Marijuana Legislation. So I have a couple of questions to ask you about that.
Yes.
Now, the Oregon Health Authority says on its website, new rules for temporary testing are going to go into effect. Briefly, what are they and why are they temporary?
Well, can't tell you really what they are because that is being done by rule coming out of the agency itself. When it comes to edibles and oils, the testing requirements have been such that it has put a kink in the hose, so to speak. And so from what I understand, the agency has gone back and temporarily made some rules easing off on some strictures that will allow more supply to move through.
Another deadline is approaching for the end of the month, the end of the year, for processes and dispensers of medical marijuana, and they describe how to interpret test results and outline responsibilities for growers and processors and dispensaries regarding testing to ensure that only marijuana that's passed all the required testing is transferred. Are there going to be the same types of rules for retail marijuana processors and dispensers?
Well, when it comes to purity of product and so forth, yes. Ultimately, it is all going to be the same. But as I say right now, the agencies, by rulemaking, are moving things around to try to make sure that the patients have what they need. They have been concerned that they've not been able to find the product that they need because of testing rules and so forth.
In August, there were reports that Oregon was on track to raise about $43 million in taxes from marijuana sales.
We're certainly raising more money than we expected as people are really flocking to the outlets to pick up the product. I was asking in committee yesterday about the distribution. There is certainly a distribution formula for marijuana tax money already in statute. However, that money has not been distributed in that way so far. The OLCC borrowed a lot of money out of the liquor fund to finance the marijuana side of the operation, and they haven't paid that back yet. They're going to be receiving payment, as I understand, quickly, and the initial debt to the liquor fund will be repaid, and then the money will go where the statute says that it is supposed to go.
Now that 31 governors are Republican in the country, the U.S. Congress has a Republican majority. Our president-elect is appointing business people to head cabinet agencies. And Oregon itself has its first Republican Secretary of State in years, Dennis Richardson. I wanted to ask you, what is your view for how you feel the country and the state may be positively, or otherwise affected by this shift in majoritarian rule, I guess?
Well, I have absolutely no idea what having a Republican president will do, or Congresses that are run by Republicans, houses of Congress. I guess the thing that I can say is having Dennis Richardson in as Secretary of State ought to be beneficial for everybody. I don't think that he is going to be a partisan individual, but in that Dennis understands the state budget like the back of his hand, being former co-chair of Ways and Means, he knows where the bones are buried. And it is going to be refreshing to have a true auditor who understands, first of all, what is in the budget, where money is typically hidden in a budget. He knows agencies extremely well, and he is going to be in charge of auditing agencies and programs.
That was Don Merrill talking with Republican Representative Carl Wilson. Mr. Wilson serves District 3, which is Grants Pass and Josephine County.
On Wednesday, the U.S. Department of Justice investigation unsealed criminal records against two former senior executives of Heritage Pharmaceuticals. Jeffrey Glazer, the former CEO, and Jason Malik, the former president, were charged with price fixing, a violation of federal antitrust law. Attorneys in 20 states immediately followed suit by accusing six other companies of unlawful price gouging practices. The new federal suit, filed in Connecticut yesterday, alleges that Mylan, Teva, and several smaller companies conspired to fix prices on generic antibiotic and diabetes medications. Connecticut Attorney General George Jepson described the unfolding litigation as, quote, kind of the tip of the iceberg. Executives and sales representatives alike reportedly huddled with competitors to discuss sensitive information at industry meetings, dinners, and girls' nights out. The objective was to avoid a price war which would reduce profitability for both companies, according to the complaint.
On Thursday, Trump nominated David Friedman to be the ambassador to Israel. Friedman's views regarding the Israeli-Palestinian conflict reflect ideologies held by Trump, who has made Islamophobic statements throughout his campaign. Trump has said that peace will only happen when Palestinians accept Israel as a Jewish state. Friedman, who has had no diplomatic experience, has served as Donald Trump's bankruptcy lawyer. Friedman has been opposed to a two-state solution where Palestine would have an independent state alongside Israel. Instead, he has supported a one-state model with Israel annexing the West Bank territory of Palestine. Friedman has financially supported Jewish settlements in the West Bank. These settlements are considered illegal by many countries under international law. As a far-right Orthodox Jew, he has expressed his belief that left-leaning Jews in America are like the Jews who aided the Nazis in the Holocaust, calling them, quote, capos, end quote. He also wants to move the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, a power move that goes against longstanding U.S. diplomatic policy in the region.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Counterspin at 5:30, followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Portland area weather tomorrow, possible morning snow showers giving way to a cloudy afternoon. Temperatures around freezing all day. East of the Cascades, partly cloudy with temperatures in the mid-20s. On this date in 1773, the Boston Tea Party took place. Samuel Adams and 60 members of the Sons of Liberty raided three British merchant ships, tossing their cargo of tea into Boston Harbor. They were protesting the British Parliament's Tea Act, which they considered an unfair tax. The quote of the day is from Samuel Adams. He said, "If ever a time should come when vain and aspiring men shall possess the highest seats of government, our country will stand in need of its experienced patriots to prevent its ruin."
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. On December 22nd, hundreds of California cartage warehouse workers are having a union election. And it's bringing temps together with direct hire warehouse workers as these workers stand up for their labor rights. While they are boldly trying to organize to improve their wages and working conditions, they say their bosses are waging a nasty anti-union campaign. The Warehouse Worker Resource Center says core employee management is violating labor law by using intimidation tactics in one-on-one meetings with the low-wage warehouse workers, while also deceiving them. The Warehouse Worker Resource Center is calling on the public to call the bosses using these anti-union tactics against their workers and tell them to stop breaking labor law. Here are the bosses' names and phone numbers where you can reach them with a message of pro-labor support for these warehouse workers. Herman Rosenthal is Cal Cartage General Manager. His number is 562-590-7026. That's 562-590-7026. Lisa Lyons is Vice President of Core Employee Management. Her number is 323-722-6232. 323-722-6232. NBA players may be the most popular union members in America, and their union, the National Basketball Players Association, has reached an agreement in principle with the NBA on a new 7-year collective bargaining agreement. Players agreed to a 51% share of basketball-related income. The new agreement will have to be ratified by the players before it goes into effect. New Jersey Education Association President Wendell Steinhauer says that the quarterly pension payments law signed Thursday is an important step toward greater state responsibility on pensions. Governor Chris Christie had repeatedly vetoed that legislation but relented and signed it. The NGEA says requiring quarterly pension payments ensures greater fiscal responsibility and is a smarter investment strategy. But the teachers' union says that still leaves the open question of how much the state will have to pay. Steinhauer says a long-term, consistent commitment to full pension funding is needed so New Jersey can, quote, dig out of the hole it's created for itself, end quote.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Hillary Clinton may be leading the popular vote by nearly 3 million votes, but it's expected that Donald Trump will officially be elected as the 45th president of the United States Monday. That's when members of the Electoral College cast their vote for president. Although there's been a concerted effort to discourage Trump electors from casting their vote for the real estate billionaire and reality show star, it's considered exceptionally unlikely that the necessary 37 of Trump's 306 electors will jump ship and prevent Trump from being elected. It's considered even more improbable that enough electors would switch their votes to give Clinton the 270 electoral votes that she would need to prevail. However, if enough electors abandoned Trump and threw the votes to someone other than Clinton, so that neither candidate had the required 270, the election would then be thrown into the House of Representatives to pick the next president. This actually happened in 1824, when the House voted for John Quincy Adams over Andrew Jackson. Jackson was the popular vote winner. That is not expected this time around, however, and in all likelihood, Donald Trump will be sworn in as our next president on Friday, January 20.
It's Friday, and it's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Few Americans have ever heard of Tom Barrack, but he's going to be a big behind-the-scenes player in Trump's Washington. Indeed, Tom's already a big player, literally in charge of parading the Donald into the White House. He chairs the Presidential Inaugural Committee, overseeing everything from numerous balls to the swearing-in. The four-day affair will, of course, be a Trumpian spectacular. Yet, Barrack insists it won't be outlandishly tacky. Quote, "The president-elect," says Barrack, "wants this to be about the people." Sure, Tom, people like you. Barrack, a longtime Trump pal, is a billionaire speculator who runs a myriad of Wall Street funds, real estate ventures, luxury resorts, and casinos. Unsurprisingly, his idea of the people turns out to be those privileged ones who will buy the premium inaugural tickets that include access to His Excellency Trump himself. Those tickets start at $25,000, but that only gets you into the bleacher seats out in right field. For the platinum seats up in the luxurious owner's suite, the price is a cool $1 million. What does that buy? An intimate dinner with the new Vice President, Mike Pence, 4 tickets to a ladies' luncheon with Miss Trump and Miss Pence, an elegant candlelight dinner with the Donald and his sidekick, Pence, the black tie inaugural ball with Trump, Pence, cabinet officials, and other governmental big shots, 4 tickets for priority seats at the official swearing-in, and priority booking at select hotels so you won't have to mingle with the commoners. Barrack expects to raise a record $75 million from corporations and fat cats wanting to endear themselves to the Trumpster. This is Jim Hightower saying, Trump has declared that nobody knows the system better than me, which is why I alone can fix it. Yeah, and now we know the price for being in on the fix.
What do the corporate powers from Wall Street to Walmart have in common? They hate the Hightower Lowdown. You can see why at www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The Pentagon has issued a formal protest to Beijing demanding the return of an underwater drone seized earlier this week by a Chinese warship in the South China Sea. The crew of the U.S. Navy vessel Bowditch discovered that the unmanned underwater vehicle was missing when they tried to retrieve it yesterday. The Bowditch, an oceanographic ship, was carrying out scientific research in international waters at the time of the incident, according to the Pentagon source. Navy personnel were trying to determine whether the seizure was a low-level action taken by Chinese sailors or a strategic action ordered by senior Chinese leaders. Donald Trump angered Chinese officials last week by holding a phone conversation with President Tsai Ing-wen of Taiwan, an island that China considers a breakaway province.
Tens of thousands of people remain stranded in Aleppo, Syria, after an on-again, off-again mass evacuation halted. Syrian government forces, backed by foreign militias and Russian air power, took over nearly all of the city's rebel-held areas in recent days, in what may be a decisive turning point in the ongoing civil war. FSRN's Nell Abram has more.
Opposing sides are trading blame for the sudden pause in the evacuations, while civilians are left in the lurch. It's unclear how many people made it out of the area before the operation was stopped. Estimates range from 3 to nearly 10,000. People purportedly trapped in eastern Aleppo have been uploading videos throughout the week. In footage released Friday, evacuees are seen first crowding the streets to leave and later returning from blocked exits.
There are thousands upon thousands of men, women, and children that are here. The fighters were not allowed to leave. I repeat, they were not allowed to leave today, nor were their families.
These are the civilians that are coming back from the crossing point, from the passage after it was closed, after Iranian militias and regime have breached the agreement. Still here in the besieged district, thousands of civilians who couldn't cross.
We asked to live in a free and democratic country, in a country that is for everyone. We asked for a free Syria, we asked to remove al-Assad. We don't want Syria in al-Assad's way, we want a free Syria. No one has supported us or even helped us. And, as you can see, we are being kicked out of our city, out of Syria. I am the son of Aleppo, the son of Aleppo, the son of Syria. I will go out of Syria and... I don't want to. I don't want to leave it.
There was no shortage of finger-pointing at the United Nations this week, with Western countries accusing Russia of blocking any and all meaningful attempts to find a non-military solution to the crisis. Aside from diplomatic sparring and words of condemnation, international powers have done little more than observe the siege and mass displacement unfold. Outgoing UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon addressed the issue Friday in his final press conference.
The carnage in Syria remains a gaping hole in the global conscience. Aleppo is now a synonym for hell. As I told the Security Council 3 days ago, we have collectively failed the people of Syria. Peace will only prevail when it is accompanied by compassion, justice, and accountability for the abominable crimes we have seen.
The eastern districts of Aleppo had been a Syrian opposition stronghold for nearly the entire duration of the conflict. The stasis was broken only after Russian military intervention.
That was FSRN's Nell Abram.
A Navy officer has pleaded not guilty to charges of stabbing a transgender woman more than 100 times in a hotel room in Mississippi. 20-year-old Duanya Hickerson made the plea in state court yesterday in response to capital murder charges, claiming that he was in a class at the time the murder occurred. His alleged victim was a 25-year-old nurse named Dee Wiggum of Shibuta. She was found dead in a hotel room shower on July 23rd. The local sheriff says a bloody shirt was recovered from the Keesler Air Force Base where Hickerson was stationed. Hickerson was named a suspect based on surveillance footage that showed a man leaving the hotel room with his shirt off.
Speaking to donors Thursday night, Hillary Clinton said that Vladimir Putin of Russia personally directed the cyber attack against Democrats to settle a score with her. Clinton claimed that Putin had never forgiven her for the accusation she made as Secretary of State in 2011 that Russian elections had been rigged that year. Clinton stated that Putin ordered the attacks, quote, because he has a personal beef against me, end quote. It is the first time Clinton has publicly addressed the impact of the hacks since the intelligence community concluded that they were specifically aimed at harming her campaign. She endorsed the proposal of a bipartisan group of senators to investigate the hacking. Clinton said the email release was one of two unprecedented events that led to her defeat. The other was the release of a letter to lawmakers by James Comey, the FBI director, shortly before the election. The letter raised new questions, which he claimed were pertinent to the closed investigation into handling of State Department emails on her server. In a follow-up letter 2 days before the election, Comey admitted that nothing new had been learned. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Tony LaTigre, Stacey Holtman, Tom Flynn, and Annie O'Brien. The producer is Ray Bodwell. Our engineer is Ian Gadbury. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Stacey Holtman.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KBOO at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. This program is open to local, national, and international issues ranging from poverty in Portland to politics in Africa. Cecil and Celeste welcome your calls. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour. Bill Resnick talks with independent journalist and climate and global sustainability activist Patrick Mazza. They discuss how many big cities in the country can defy Trumpism and show how to radically cut greenhouse gas emissions in less than 10 years. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Locus Focus. In this episode, we speak with high school student activist